Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Are you a Republican or a Democrat, an independent? What about when you first registered to vote? How many times have you changed over a lifetime? We talk about the political weight of shifting alliances this week as the Dakota political junkies wrestle the state's top political headlines to the ground. Joining us today, Jonathan Ellis with the Argus Leader in Sioux Falls. Jonathan, welcome.
Hey, Lori.
Hey, Roger Whittle, Watertown Public Opinion Managing Editor. Roger, welcome as well.
Thanks, Larry.
Jonathan, let's start a little bit. I'm looking at an article by Dana Ferguson, your colleague at the Argus Leader, talking about South Dakota Citizens for Liberty and the quest to find out who has switched political parties in the past. Tell me what you know.
Well, they've solved the mystery of where all the Democrats were going, didn't they? They were registering as Republicans. Everybody wanted to know, where are all the Democrats going? Turns out they've infiltrated the Republican Party. Anyhow, no, so
Jonathan's on fire this morning already.
Oh well. Anyway, I'm trying to get through. I'm sorry. I'm a big U.S. soccer fan, and I'm trying to get through the rather devastating loss last night that took place. So. But anyway, back to the topic at hand here. Yeah, so you have a group in Rapid City, Citizens for Liberty, that apparently has analyzed the voter registration files of lawmakers and found that a number of Republicans in the legislature had once been registered as Democrats, they contend. Even more recently, in the last, say, 15, 20 minutes, Laura Hubbell, who's a candidate for governor, put out a statement saying Dan Lederman, the GOP chairman, had once been registered as a Democrat in Iowa. So this is apparently a big scandal. I don't know if they've realized yet that Donald Trump was also once registered as a Democrat, as was, get this, Ronald Reagan, a Democrat. So I don't know. The inquiry should be expanded, certainly beyond the legislature. But, you know, there are a lot of things to say about this. I mean, some people are actually proud when they get people to switch parties and join their party. It's a sense that maybe their ideas are sort of winning in the marketplace of ideas, right?
Right.
But apparently that the South Dakota Citizens for Liberty sees this as some kind of threat to the Republican Party. And they view that, these former Democrats are not being Republican enough, apparently.
Hmm. Roger, you want to weigh in on this?
I do. You know, he makes a good point, Jonathan. When I first saw the headline of the story, I thought they were bragging about this. but it turns out they were not. They were actually worried about ideological purity being compromised. Very strange move by this group out there. I really don't know what they're trying to or what they hope to accomplish by this. I know, can you imagine the Democratic Party putting out a story saying one in seven Democrats used to be a Republican? The Democrats would be partying in the streets if that were the case. but they're looking at it as a bad thing. It was an interesting, bizarre story that came out.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan always has a good point, so of course he had a good point. And what do you think, Jonathan, the motivation is behind this? This is like a ideological shaming?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that that's what they're going after. I mean, that it's part of this civil war within the Republican Party that exists, across the country. And, you have ideological purists, people who think that they're pure, that they define what it means to be a Republican versus those who they feel as rhinos, a Republican in name only. And it's an attempt to sort of define what a conservative is, what a conservative isn't. It's interesting. To some of them, you have to be sort of anti-immigrant or anti, they've tried to stake out what a true conservative is and what a true conservative isn't. And there are others in the Republican Party who sort of disagree with what that label of what you have to believe in order to be a conservative. So it's just sort of a fight over what the brand is.
Right. And is it even accurate? We're seeing some lawmakers saying, I don't even think that's right.
Oh, in terms of there's some lawmakers.
In terms of who exactly they're saying switched parties, some lawmakers are saying that, are crying foul of that.
Yeah, Jean Hunoff down in Yankton said she was never registered as a Democrat. I think Deb Soholt, they complained that she wasn't even registered to vote, and she said that she may have missed the mark when she, you know, a box or something. Some of this stuff is just, but yeah, there are some of the lawmakers are sort of disputing the accuracy of this.
Roger, what is there for voters to care about in this conversation? What's our takeaway?
Well, I'm not sure if there is one, although it's caused for some good conversation with us three today, and I think that's probably all we can take from this. Like I say, I don't understand the motivation behind this group to do that, other than the same way with kind of both parties are trying to see who can be more conservative or more liberal than the next. And if you're not conservative enough, you know, you're not a true Republican, or if not liberal enough, you're not a true Democrat. It's kind of a sad situation. Where do the rest of us fit in this situation?
Right. And I think this is the first time I realized that information was public, frankly. I didn't realize someone could look at the history of, you know, when you're 18 and you first registered versus, you know, how you registered or changed it last time you were at the driver's license office.
Sometimes voter registrations are public information, as are sort of voting histories, and they are public records in part because politicians will want access to the information when they're running for election.
Right. Jonathan, what about this idea that sometimes in South Dakota people change their parties to vote in a specific primary?
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, I've heard Democrats say that they've registered as Republican because the action is generally where in the Republican primary. I mean, and so they want to vote for the candidate that they find most appealing, even though they're Democrats. So that's certainly true. There's no doubt about that. There are some Democrats who've registered as Republicans so they can participate in that primary process. Keeping in mind that, you know, the Democrats have an open primary where independents can vote in their primary. Republicans, however, have a closed primary that's only open to registered Republicans.
Right. Let's switch topics so we make sure to get to everything. Let's talk about the Keystone XL pipeline and the Trump administration telling the courts that they really don't have any say on his recent decision to issue a presidential permit. Roger, do you want to start with Keystone XL?
Yeah, it's an interesting story again. Of course, President Obama would not permit the pipeline to go through, and one of the first things that the Trump administration did was okay it, and now the courts are looking at this situation too, because for many reasons. I mean, there's questions now whether or not the pipeline will even be built because of the economic situation, the low oil prices, and it wouldn't be worth for the Canadian company to actually build the pipeline. Nebraska hasn't even approved it yet, so there's a lot of things up in the air. But the base of this story was that the Trump administration is saying that they have final say and the court should not even be involved in it at this point.
Jonathan, your take on that?
Yeah, it's a separation of powers issue, and it would be interesting then to see what a federal judge is going to say about that. I can see some judges perhaps being convinced of that argument and others not. So, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But, I mean, this whole saga has sort of just dragged out for years and years and years. I mean, the permitting process took forever under the Obama administration, and finally was at the end was just kind of shelved, revived by the Trump administration. And then this lawsuit about how, you know, well, that the environmental assessment or impact study wasn't thorough enough. You know, that's contention of the lawsuit. You know, all of this is just sort of a symbolic fight over sort of the future of energy development, and certainly environmentalists who oppose, exploitation of fossil fuels.
How does this play out?
Roger. This began in 2008, was when the pipeline was first proposed. I don't think people realize that it's been going on that long, and it's nowhere near a conclusion at this point.
How much do economic factors play into it now in 2017, Roger?
Well, I think the economic factors will come in on whether or not the company wants to build it. I don't think they have any relevancy on the issue here about separation of powers, whether the president or the courts can decide it. If it's not financially feasible for this company to build it, it won't be built, regardless of what a court or a president says.
Do the protests at the Dakota Access Pipeline and the impact on North Dakota, the eventual impact on the company, is that part of the conversation about economic or financial feasibility, Jonathan? What do you think?
I don't know that the protests necessarily are. I mean, you know, the economics of the issue when it was proposed in 2008. Can you remember that summer of 2008 when the gas prices just kept going higher and higher and higher? You know, we're not probably going to have low oil forever. I mean, the price of oil will go back up at some point, unless there's sort of a wholesale change to clean energy. And I don't know of anybody who really, you know, credible experts who really think that that's something that can happen just kind of on a turn of a dime like that. It's something that's transitional. So assuming that, you know, we face a future in which oil prices get higher, and they have to be fairly high again in order to make that the tar sands oil to work economically. But you know that becomes, I think, then a viable project. But the economics right now just aren't there for it.
All right. Speaking of viable projects, Jonathan, let's go to Sioux Falls and talk about the event center. I feel like you and I really haven't had the chance to dig into that. So what's the latest on the, you know, event center panels? You know, where do you want to begin? What hasn't been said yet?
Well, the administration has defended its claim that they made 2 years ago that, you know, the city received $1 million settlement from some contractors who were involved in the paneling of the Denny Sanford Premier Center, and sort of the warping panels were bent, not put on, not put on necessarily the way they should have been. So the administration claimed to have $1 million settlement. And when the settlement, we had to take it was a confidential settlement. We took it to the Supreme Court, and then looked into the settlement, and it turns out that it wasn't really $1 million settlement at all. And so the administration has had to, defend itself on, they claim, it really was $1 million. It just was money. Most of the money was, ours already, so they've had to defend themselves there. Most recently now there's another report, sort of backing up their confidential settlement that they refused to release to the public. They say it's a draft and, it was done more than, I want to say, 3 years ago now. And it's going to be a draft forever. And there's a exemption in open records in our law that allows government agencies to keep secret draft reports, things that are not final. So that's where we're at now, and that report would, presumably would talk about who was responsible for this panel issue, and presumably the city of Sioux Falls shares some responsibility that they've never publicly admitted to in this issue.
Roger, let's talk about the long-term implications of this sort of happening in Sioux Falls, because it expands beyond simply the event center, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and Sioux Falls, the city, has found an interesting loophole here for the public records law. You have use taxpayer money to have a study done, get a draft report, and then never complete it, so you never have to... you never have to reveal what the money was spent for. Pretty interesting, but I think eventually, if they don't complete the draft, then that draft eventually should be considered the final report, would be my suggestion anyway. So I think in this case, the city, the mayor, is someone's got to take the shovel away from him, because he keeps just digging himself deeper and deeper into this hole by trying to keep things secret. And glad the Argus is down there fighting to get these things into public so we know what's going on.
Jonathan,
hey, Roger,
it has.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Roger, you do not have a future in government.
Just so. Thank God.
if you think that these things should be open to the public, no, Roger, you will not. You will not get a position in government. So
where do I get these silly ideas?
Jonathan, here's a big one for you. What needs to change? What needs to change with open records and government transparency so that something like this doesn't happen again, that still protects the business interests and the conversations that folks would like to have where the sun doesn't shine?
Well, I mean, you know, our open records law in 2009 dates back to 2009, and it was a big step forward. But there were a lot of exemptions in that law, and I think some of those have to be looked at. And I think Billy Sutton, who's running a Democratic for governor, has proposed looking at some of those exemptions. I would certainly support that. I recognize the fact that business interests and there are privacy concerns and things of that nature, but I think what we're seeing is that governments, not only just with regard to this event center issue here in Sioux Falls, but we've got EB5 issues, we've got the gear up issues. I mean, there's the government in South Dakota, and South Dakota has probably the weakest open records law in the country, is able to hide a lot of information from the public. To me, that's unacceptable.
Roger, are we at the tipping point in the state, or is the furor going to die down until the next revelation?
Well, I think the people who are fighting for open records have to keep fighting, because I know I even heard one of the city council members in Sioux Falls calling this whole thing a witch hunt, and the press should just mind their own business. And with that kind of an attitude out there, we cannot let up on keeping these kind of things open.
That particular city councilor, Rick Rolfing, that was extremely discouraging for him to say a witch hunt when essentially a lawsuit shows that the government lied. Blatantly lied, and he calls it a witch hunt? That is ridiculous, and unfortunately, I like Rex Rolfing on an individual level, but his comments that he made were ridiculous, and frankly, I'm happy to see that his time on the city council is coming to an end.
Jonathan, how is this impacting the mayor's race in Sioux Falls?
You know, right now, I think a lot of people are sort of kind of waiting to see what happens. I mean, we've had some candidates, certainly Greg Jamison, some candidates say that, you know, are not happy with how this issue has played out in terms of the secrecy. I suspect that this report that I had talked to you about earlier that is being kept secret, I suspect that the next mayor will release that probably on day one if it hasn't already been released.
Greg Jamison, if memory serves, went to Pier and introduced legislation that would sort of impact this. It did not pass, but it was something that was important to him on a long-term basis. Yes, am I remembering that correctly, Jonathan?
Yeah, you're correct. And actually, that legislation, it would have dealt with this issue, but even more broadly, the one of the exemptions in the law allows governments to enter into confidential settlements in lawsuits. And what his bill would have done would have ended that. It's important to know that our lawsuit to get this settlement opened up was confidential settlements that take place outside of a lawsuit. So the government still have this ability within a lawsuit, enter a confidential settlement. That exists under law, and that was what Greg Jamison was trying to do away with. Most states, that's just not an option. It's, you know, the federal government doesn't settle lawsuits confidently. It's taxpayer money, you know, and so that was what Greg Jamison was. He would have dealt with the issue far more broadly and frankly, more impactfully. My guess is now, given this kind of narrow court ruling, and that's all we were after because it's all we could really have. The law says what the law says. But my guess is now government agencies will, if they want to get in a confidential settlement, they'll say, well, hey, we got to go down to the courthouse, file a lawsuit, and then, bam, then they can enter a confidential lawsuit. So the Supreme Court victory that we had was extremely narrow, and government officials will be able to circumvent that very easily as the law is written now. So that needs to change.
Jonathan, what about Mayor Mike Huther, Sioux Falls mayor currently? What does this do to his political future?
It's not going to be good for him. Nothing. I don't know that he had a political future, but he abandoned the Democratic Party back in, I think, December or January. So he doesn't have a political party. It's fairly hard to win an election if you don't have the backing of the infrastructure of a political party. So I don't know that he had a future to begin with. But this is not going to help it.
Roger, what else should we touch on today? What's making news in the state?
Well, won't the Republican Party welcome the mayor with open arms?
Right.
Just make a switch, Mike Huther. It's easy as pie.
Exactly.
Check the box. Jonathan Ellis is with Argus Leader Media in Sioux Falls. You can find his work at argusleader.com. Jonathan, thank you.
Hey, thank you, Lori. See you, Roger.
You bet.
Roger Whittle, managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. Thanks, Roger, so much.
Thank you for having me.